Hi, welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast, our prequel episode, if you will, where we talk about our project analyzing the American Film Institute and their 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films ever made. Warning, there are spoilers ahead. This podcast is meant to be listened to after you've seen the film.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Okay, so the Top 100 Project has reached a dozen. This is our 12th podcast for AFI Movies. It is It Happened One Night. So It Happened One Night was 35th on the Top 100 list in 1998 and 46th in 2007. So this is the first AFI film we've covered that stayed on the list between the 2 years, but did drop from 1998 to 2007, and 11 spots is the biggest such drop we'll see until we get to All About Eve in 1950. It was released February 23rd, 1934, and yet another box office hit, Bev. Most of these movies we've done so far have been big hits. It Happened One Night is no exception. And one more thing I'll say before I bring you in here, and I said in the last podcast for Duck Soup, there are not a lot of comedies on the list, but here's the fifth of the first 12. So, comedy, It Happened One Night, Clark Gable, Claudette Colbert, your thoughts?
I loved it. I was never bored.
What?
I know.
How can this be?
It's just so charming and fun and funny, and Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert have this incredible chemistry. Yep. They're so great together. They're so great, period. And even the supporting cast is amazing, and Capra just, you know, it's rare to find a really well-executed romantic comedy, and this is one of those, like, perfect romantic comedies, which, you know, as a human that possesses two X chromosomes, it is statistically impossible for me to not love a well-executed romantic comedy,
hey,
which I did.
Me too, when they're done
right.
It's
a great movie.
And Frank Capra did it right.
Yeah, he really did. I loved it. Like, I just enjoyed every minute of it. No caveats, no buts, which, you know, I think this is the first movie that we've done where I have an uncomplicated opinion, just, yes, I loved it. It was great. Go see it immediately.
I'm pleasantly surprised. I don't know if you'd be quite this much of a fan. I thought you'd like it, but I'm very glad to have heard your huge laughter during two of the better laughs, probably the two best laughs we've had on the project so far, which those two scenes were the quit balling, when Cable screams at Colbert during their play acting.
When she's the plumber's daughter.
Yes, when they're faking out the people who are searching for her. And at the very end, one of my very favorite lines in any movie has got to be the whole, "Do you love her?" "Yes, but don't hold that against me. I'm going to scream myself."
So well done. Such a great moment.
Yeah, they're two really great laughs.
One of the other great scenes is it's super famous, the scene where they're hitchhiking. Mm. And the buildup is huge. And of course, you know it's coming. Like, the scene's so famous and it's been lampooned and redone 100 times. I've seen it so many times.
We've also hitchhiked that way. Where you're Gable and I'm Colbert.
Well, yeah, it's your legs we use because they're so nice. But yeah, it's such a famous scene. I knew exactly what was coming, but it was still so funny and charming, like, that it didn't even matter that you knew exactly what was going to happen.
And what comes out of it but Grand Theft Auto?
I know. It's classic comedy trope of Grand Theft Auto.
Well, it should have been called It Happened Over Several Nights.
Yeah, I know. The title's completely strangely inaccurate.
Well, it's based on a short story called Night Bus, and there's a sequence in the movie where there's a little billboard that says Night Bus, and I point out to you, hey, there's the name of the movie, or what could have been the name of the movie. And the short story is by Samuel Hopkins Adams. It was adapted by Robert Riskin. We're going to get to Riskin and Capra and a few other people a little later on. But I guess this, you could call this the story of the unemployed newsman and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
I was trying
she's
to think
not
of,
Paris Hilton, that's not fair.
I was thinking of, trying to think of a better
she's
analogy.
She's a spoiled heiress, but she's not...
Nowhere near as bad as Paris Hilton.
No, she's not an idiot.
No. It's also Planes, Trains, and Automobiles without John Candy's girth.
Yeah, they go through, like, all the various ways of transportation in their desperate attempt to get to New York.
Those two guys don't fall in love, but very similar arc.
They have a bromance,
yeah. Well, there have been many road movies made over the years. I think this is the first road movie we've done. And I guess the thing we probably should have said off the top, this is thought of as the first screwball comedy. There aren't a ton more of those on this list. There's one in a few movies from now, Bringing Up Baby, which will be an interesting podcast because it was trash when it came out, unlike this movie, which was well received by everybody.
Well, I read that it had mediocre reviews.
Which? It Happened One Night?
Yeah, and that it had mediocre reviews and had lukewarm box office.
No, the box office was pretty good.
But when it got wide release, It was word of mouth that caught on, and then it went gangbusters.
Well, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true. And that's the way they always release movies for. I don't know how long. Probably up until when we were teenagers, probably, is when they started doing the whole incredibly wide release. Well, okay, that's not fair. Jaws, I guess, really brought that in. That's when we were little babies. But really, even then, they would release movies slowly. And it wasn't this whole thing where it's just released to thousands of theaters the way it is now.
I feel like it wasn't even that long ago that they were still doing it. Well, that's what I'm saying,
yeah. And you sometimes see that.
Now you get the buzz from the festivals.
Yeah, that's the version of a slow release.
But then also, I mean, Iron Man 3 was released internationally before it was even released domestically.
So it was Skyfall.
Strange, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Times are really changing when it comes to that.
Because they're making more money overseas.
Yeah, well, there you go. And that's what they're always going to do. That's what they're always going to play to, is what makes a movie the most money.
Yeah.
But back to screwball comedy.
Back to screwball comedy, but back to It Happened One Night. You can't really say it's not really love at first drunken sight. Because he is drunk when he's on that bus, if you recall.
He's
quitting, and he actually gets fired. But he's trying to confronting his boss on the phone. He's the stereotypical drunk newsman, and he's just been turfed. But he's obviously liking this woman. But they don't play it too obviously. Some of the better romantic comedies have had that moment. I've talked to you when we saw Groundhog Day back in February.
Yeah.
There's right in the first scene when Phil sees Rita, and she's goofing around with the chroma key.
Yeah.
There's a look on his face that says right there, he loves her. He'll never admit it. You wouldn't know it until later on in the movie that he ever liked her until he starts warming to her. But right, there's a look on Bill Murray's face. He likes her right then.
He's such a great actor that he sells it really well, too.
So there have been many movies that have oversold the idea of these people are going to end up together. And we know they will.
This movie, though, it felt really organic. I didn't feel like they loved each other right away. It's like they grew on each other. Yeah. They had that banter, which is a big part of screwball comedies, and it really felt like they fell in love.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
One of the better examples of chemistry. I'm going to ask you something about, and let me give you a bit of a build-up first. Do you think the movie is antiquated? I guess almost every movie of this era has to be. It's almost 80 years old, but let me give you a bit of a build-up before you get to it. So there's antiquated moments everywhere. There's newspapers. There's pipe smoking.
Oh, yeah.
There's,
on a bus.
Buses as a major mode of transportation.
Well, they're smoking on a bus.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Smoking inside. I guess the other thing that's something that doesn't happen anymore, an antiquation, if you will, is the Hays Code was just coming into effect.
Yeah.
So the nipples that Claudette Colbert sports are...
Pre-code movies had some serious nipple action. A
couple movies out of three now. King Kong with Faye Ray and now
Claudette Intolerance Colbert. Had, I think, full boob in it, didn't it?
Yeah, I believe some of the background people, yeah. I don't know if that's really a problem that those things are dated, but did you feel like the movie was?
It kept surprising me when I would see these things that would remind me how old the movie was. A great example is the style of the bus and the car that they end up stealing.
The jalopy.
Yeah, stuff like that. And I'd be like, why? It would surprise me to see these kind of antiquated things in this movie that actually felt like, and on all the movies we've seen, I would say this feels like the most modern movie.
Set in that time. It's not in any way.
Because it's a story, because they didn't have to, you know, it's the formula still gets used all the time. There's still dozens of movies made every year in Hollywood that follow this exact formula, which certainly the formula wasn't created with this movie, but it was the movie that
perfected it
and made it very popular. After this movie was such a big hit, that's when Hollywood really made the screwball comedy. But also you could say, to me it's the rom-com formula.
Yes.
I actually have I made a list of the tropes that make a screwball comedy, like what makes it stand apart from other comedies. And
did the internet tell you so?
What? No, my really smart brains told me so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I just totally knew this from going to film school at Wikipedia University.
Wiki you.
Yes. So every screwball comedy, if it's a perfect screwball comedy, would contain class criticism, where you would have one character who's of a significantly higher class than the other, and then one or the other is going to be placed in a kind of fish out of water situation, and often the rich member of the partnership would be the one that can't cope in living in the real world. And the people attribute the popularity of this film and other comedies that followed this formula to the Great Depression and just how cathartic it was for audiences to watch, you know, Ellie in this movie, watch Ellie struggle. She gets robbed. She gives her money away without really a second thought. She doesn't understand the value of things.
She sort of starves.
She starves because she won't eat raw carrots, which was surprising to me. Yeah. I didn't realize that raw carrots were the food of the proletariat, but apparently. So that's class criticism is a big component. They would contain a self-confident, stubborn female protagonist, which obviously this movie had. The witty, fast repartee, which wasn't just in comedies. It existed in lots of other genres as well, but always in screwball comedies. Romance, they often had a romantic component. And often they also had the hidden disguises, life on the run, kind of just like It Happened One Night, where she's kind of pretending to be something she's not. You have movies like this where she's rich and pretending to be poor, but also went the other way around, where, say, the Lady Eve would be an example, mm-hmm. where she's poor pretending to be rich and various other examples.
I was just thinking that Preston Sturges, looking at your little list there and listening to you describe it,
yeah.
hit on probably every one of those in his...
Yeah.
He didn't make that many movies, but most of his movies were those types.
Yeah.
Sullivan's Travels is on this list. We're a little ways away from it, but Sullivan's Travels definitely hits mm-hmm. probably every single one of those points.
Mm-hmm. And it's still popular today. It doesn't take a Great Depression for people to like watching the foibles of the rich and watching them get knocked down a peg or two.
That's always been a trope in movies.
Sure, yeah, but it's fun to watch. It's fun to take the piss out of them.
Well, those two eras are probably the best ones that we can think of that play on this. The Depression in the 30s and now. Because of the divide between the rich and the poor, it would have been bad then, and it's awful now. It's remarkably
bad now. Oh,
yeah,
yeah. It's such a popular and ubiquitous genre that there's plenty of movies that, you know, just take advantage of some of these tropes, and someone like the Coen brothers that'll use screwball comedy elements in movies that aren't even really comedies, but it's kind of to play with the audience because we're also primed to understand these movies through and through. And that's why I say, like, It Happened One Night feels like the first modern movie that we saw. It's the first movie where I just... thoroughly understood the language and knew exactly what to expect. You know, these are formulas that are very familiar to me. And I guess, like, other movies are close. Certainly, the Chaplin movies would be an example. King Kong would be an example. But it's amazing when you think 79 years, mm-hmm. and I think you could film this movie making very few changes in the script today, and they would eat it up. It would make a killing in the box office.
It was remade. We'll get to that.
I can think of movies
a little later on in the influence section.
Yeah, I can think of movies that would never be considered a remake, but practically follow it beat by beat.
Yeah.
You know, a movie like Sweet Home Alabama. It ends practically the same way.
Okay. Yeah.
It is an example.
Thank God that the Gable, Colbert, and Capra classic brought Sweet Home Alabama.
Oh yeah.
To thanks. The masses. Thank you, Frank Capra.
Lots of people do it poorly. Like, the rom-com, part of the pleasure of this movie is that you watch so many terrible rom-coms that it's...
When one hits, it's so memorable.
It's just so refreshing to watch one that's been executed properly.
I think horror and comedy are the two best examples of genres that when they work are, for me at least, stand out as good a thing as you'll see.
Yes. Yeah,
so I'm not saying the drama and war films and westerns are easy, but I do think that they are less hit and miss.
Yeah, there's something about horrors and rom-coms that make them hard to do well. So the things that went right in this movie, the plot is pretty sparse. It's just enough to keep the action going and keep it focused on the characters. The casting is incredible. Every single person in this movie is
as I was being. Let's get into the cast now.
Yeah.
So we'll get to Gable and Colbert in a second. But about the main characters, Peter and Ellie. A lot of actors were approached to be in this movie.
Yeah.
They rejected it. I think largely because Columbia Pictures was thought of as a cheap studio. They were Poverty Row, they were called. Myrna Loy was one person who turned it down, and she later said the final product was nothing like the script she had read, which suggests regret on her part. And Val Kilmer said the same thing about Blue Velvet, by the way. He had a problem with it. He said it was like pornography, what I read, but mm-hmm. what he saw on the screen, he said, I would have done that.
You got to give directors credit for...
A shooting script is different than the script that's first sent out, and then the final product is different too, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of a useless piece of trivia. Ward Bond, who plays the bus driver in the beginning of the film, he appears in his first of 7 AFI movies.
That's incredible.
A few of them are uncredited. This one, and I think it's Gone with the Wind he was in. But he was in, I can't think of them all. I looked through, I forget already. Maltese Falcon, he's the cop in It's Wonderful Life. He was in 7. I think that's the most anybody ever was.
That's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm. All the supporting parts. He's got a bigger role in The Searchers and Wonderful Life, but anyway. Okay, let's get into Gable and Colbert then. So apparently the actors got along fine, which is surprising considering neither one of them wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Good old Clark Gable is only the second leading man after Charlie Chaplin we've seen so far to have 3 movies on the top 100 list in total. He's also got Mutiny on the Bounty and Gone with the Wind. The Mutiny on the Bounty is very soon and Gone with the Wind is a little ways away. But Gable did this movie against his will. He was loaned out by MGM as a humbling experience because he rejected another part at MGM. when he got there the first day on set, he said something like, let's get this over with. Mm-hmm. So again, maybe the script really wasn't that good, and then the shooting changed things. So here's useless factoids that fascinate me. Gable was nominated for an Oscar 3 times as Best Actor, 3 total. This was one of them, and he did win the Oscar. He was nominated also for Mutant and the Bounty, Gone with the Wind. All mm-hmm. 3 movies were AFIs, all 3 movies were nominations for him, and all 3 movies won Best Picture.
Did he ever win another Oscar after that one night?
The Gable and Colbert only ever won this one. And one more thing about Clark Gable, which people may have heard before, but if they haven't, it's kind of interesting. Bugs Bunny was inspired by Gable's ears, his way of talking during the carrot-eating scene where he's munching on the carrots and talking quickly.
Yeah, Fritz Freleng apparently was a huge fan of this movie, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure if it's confirmed, but it's suspected that he got all kinds of inspiration for Bugs Bunny from Clark Gable in this movie.
There's a character named Bugs.
Yeah, imaginary character.
Gable makes up to scare off
that guy. But somebody calls him Doc. I think the same guy mm-hmm. calls him Doc at one point.
And the things I just mentioned.
Yeah, okay. And the things you just mentioned. Yeah. That's quite the legacy to have to be like somewhat responsible for the creation of one of the most iconic characters in history, in modern history.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if Gable knew that.
Yeah.
Now, as for Claudette Colbert, I love that, Colbert. And we're big fans of Stephen Colbert. She was actually French. I did not know that. Colbert also, as I said, did not want to do the movie. She was paid a lot of money for this one, and she was also promised a short schedule of 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Yet she still badmouthed the movie when it came out, and she called it a turkey. I don't know if Gable's reaction was recorded by anybody, or if he hated the movie once it was done, if he changed his mind, or whatever else. I said they got along fine during production, so maybe they're just being professionals, which they should be. You know, no matter how much you hate a movie, this is your job. We said, I think it was last podcast, we talked about how this was the job for these people. They weren't out there like Tom Cruise making whatever movie they want to make.
Yeah.
They were, as I said, they had to make this movie.
Yeah, like Gable was making $2,000 a week from MGM, whether he was making a movie or not. Yeah. So they loaned him out and they got paid $2,500 for his time spent on the movie. So it didn't matter to them either way.
And then he won an Oscar and got all this success with this other studio, and it really helps them out too. It helps MGM out.
Did this make Columbia in any way? They must have made a fortune, perhaps. That's what got them back.
They were called Poverty Row, and then they got them anymore. Into the big leagues. I think that Capra worked with Columbia his whole career. He certainly would have for a while. He made You Can't Take It With You, which won the Oscar for Best Picture and also for Best Director, like mm-hmm. this did a few years later. So, yeah, it was a studio that had no identity, and I think this was the movie that gave it that.
Mm-hmm.
But a little bit more about Colbert. So I would call her fairly liberated for one of the 30s. However, it's not a truly liberated movie by any means. Her father is a nice man, actually, especially in the latter mm-hmm. half of the movie. But he runs her life, really.
Yeah.
While Peter believes she should have a punch in the face now and then, whether she needs it or not.
colloquial spousal abuse.
So Colbert isn't just a spoiled, unlikable whiner at all. And she's actually very likable. Anyway, I shouldn't even use the word unlikable because she's never really unlikable.
No, it's true.
But when I was watching it again, I've seen it many times now. I'm watching the movie thinking, this is actually, for a movie of this era, fairly liberated, but I don't know if it is.
She's traveling by herself. She's a young woman. She's defying her father.
But without him, she would have died, I think the movie's sort of saying.
You mean without Gable? Gable.
Yeah.
She would have just had to resort to call her father way sooner.
Which she does in the end anyway.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
fair enough. But then she still is reliant on men. Let's lead it into the director then. Good old Frank Capra, one of the greats. Capricorn. We'll definitely get more into that with Mr. Smith and Wonderful Life. As much as I love Wonderful Life, and I like Mr. Smith too, this movie avoids what became known as Capricorn. He was extremely corny, but he was also likable. He touched the heartstrings, and he was great at that. As I said, Mr. Smith, Goes to Washington, It's a Wonderful Life, also on this list. We're a little ways away from both, but they are upcoming in the months ahead.
I think we talked before about how I'm like allergic to sentimentality in movies a lot, but he wins me over anyway. I love It's a Wonderful Life, and that is a corny movie, mm-hmm. but I forgive it. Maybe he just has something, he does something different. I don't know what it is. And while we're talking about corniness, there was no music. There was no soundtrack to this movie, was there? Was there a score? Did you hear a score?
I don't know. If there was, it wasn't much.
There wasn't much. And that's like my peeve in movies. I hate overdone scores, like overdramatic scores. Maybe there is at some points where I just didn't notice it, but I remember there being some pretty like emotional hits that weren't accompanied by music. They just let the actors do the work.
Yeah, okay, well then, there you go. We've talked before, we said it on Frankenstein and King Kong. Frankenstein had no music at all, except for the opening and end credits. King Kong and music all the way throughout, a classic score. We're going to talk about it a lot more as we go on. The music is a crutch. But when it's done right, at least it's memorable. One technical note that I picked up right away with this movie is that it uses wipes as transitions. And other than George Lucas and Akira Kurosawa, that's not a common thing in movies, but Capra used it here. And I'm going to have to look for the next two movies when we do get to them if he used them again. I don't remember if he does.
Speaking of technical things, I've talked about this before a lot when we were talking about silent films, and that's the mobility of the camera. You really see the restriction of the camera mobility in this. Yeah, the camera doesn't move. There's places the camera can't go. There's scenes that if it was a silent film, you would have for sure gotten a close-up. Like, there were some scenes where you're actually dying for them to just move the camera to get a reaction shot, but it just plays out in wide shot. The one I'm thinking in particular is a scene where Ellie confesses her love to Pete. She's having this emotional, heart-wrenching scene where she's telling him how much she cares about him, and you only see his reaction. They never cut to her face. You never get a reaction shot.
Well, I guess you're getting his reaction shot.
You're just getting his reaction shot, and there's lots of other scenes, too, where the camera just stays in one place, and...
That could have been a Capra's decision, though, to say that this scene is about Gable, even though she's the one that's delivering the emotional, oh, I love you, Peter, I love you, and take me away, and all this stuff. It's about his... not really reacting to that, but wanting
to. Yeah, but I suspect there was lots of restrictions. It's a very dialogue-heavy movie, so they would have always had to keep sound in consideration, which means the camera would have always been in elaborately housed. If you have to shoot a movie in 4 weeks to accommodate Colbert's schedule, you don't have time to take an entire day to reset the camera so that you can get that reaction shot.
That may have been the reason it was not in there, too.
Yeah. I mean, and I noticed it in other movies from this same time period. Philadelphia Story comes to mind, where it's just a static camera. The cinematography isn't very interesting, and that's probably a restriction of technology at the time.
One more thing I want to say about Capra is his cohort in crime, Robert Riskin, the writer of the movie. He regularly worked with Capra, and all five of his Oscar nominations for writing are on Capra-directed films. Sorry for the Oscar references. We don't want to be too big on those, but it's a lot to say with this one. We're going to get to that in a few minutes here. And one other note of note, Robert Riskin was also married to Faye Ray for 15 years. Oh. And she was the star of a recent AFI-er, King Kong. Usually I have a whole section of my notes here about the ending. I just have one line this time. And it's the first AFI movie on our list to end with a not-so-subtle suggestion of sexual congress between our two leading players. It's the Walls of Jericho fall.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's so great, the way that played out. I loved it.
Yeah. Okay, two more things I'm going to say, random points to make before we get to the awards and influence section. Actually, maybe this is an influence part of it. Stalin and Hitler were fans of this movie.
I know, I read that.
I don't know what that means.
I think that just speaks to its universal appeal. That's all I can think. Who doesn't love this movie?
So you said that a lot of movies of the modern era are essentially remakes of this movie, but it was actually remade in 1956 with Jack Lemmon and June Allison, and you can't run away from it. Okay, we'll get to the finale of it now, which, as always, is the awards and recognition section. Now, for those who don't know, It Happened One Night won the Oscar Grand Slam. Well, plus one, I guess. A Grand Slam is four runs in baseball. This won five awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Snort from Fox.
We have a rogue dog.
And Best Screenplay. But not only was it the first to win the Big Five, the first of three movies that did that, these were also its only nominations. So it's the rare Best Picture winner that swept all of its nominations. Mm-hmm. The other two movies that did the Big Five were One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. So 41 years it took for it to happen again, and then it was another 16, and not since.
Yeah.
But only three times ever.
And you know, it was kind of funny about that is that if that movie came out today, even if it was a huge hit, it would never even be nominated for any of these categories.
Probably not.
Romantic comedies just don't even hit the radar, with the exception of something that really kind of goes above and beyond, something like Silver Linings Playbook. Annie Hall is a great example, too. But those are kind of more concept.
They're the outliers, too.
Yeah, they're just more kind of sophisticated movies that also happen to be funny and romantic, not the way that It Happened One Night is this formulaic rom-com. Of course, it wrote the formula. It totally deserves to win those awards. But at this point, I don't even think, like, if a great romantic comedy that was as good and well-executed as this came out today and people loved it and it, you know, made lots of money at the box office, I still don't think that they would even bother campaigning for an Oscar.
I think it might have gotten actor and actress nominations for the two of them, and it may have gotten a nomination for the script, but probably not picture director. I would agree with that part of what you're saying. I think it had a chance at the other three, though.
Maybe.
And one more thing I want to say about the Oscars and this movie, I was also reading this, Of Human Bondage with Bette Davis was not nominated, And the other contender that didn't get nominated was Frederick March in 1934 as the Barretts of Wimpole Street. He played Robert Browning, I think it was. So neither one of them were nominated. The consensus seemed to be that they both would have won. And Colbert didn't show up for the Oscar ceremony, which back then was not a secret ballot anyway. But she didn't show up because she thought...
did show up in the end. Someone dragged her off. Dragged her off a train.
But she wasn't at the show and ready to take her home her award. She didn't think she was going to win.
It's kind of an interesting story. She was on her way on a train voyage. Mm-hmm. And somebody who knew she was going to win went and got her and dragged her just in time.
That happened one night.
Yes.
This movie happens over several nights. But yeah, anyway, the consensus seemed to be from a lot of insiders that those two, that March and Davis should have won. But anyway, we could talk about Oscar snubs all night in a 3-hour podcast. So the other AFI list that had happened one night was on. It was 38th on the top 100 passions. Number 8 on the top 100 laughs, so a top 10 shot there. Number 3 in the rom-com category on the genres list. So pretty well respected by the AFI. And again, a movie that made the National Film Registry's list of movies that Congress is preserving in 1993. I think almost every movie we've done, if not every single one, has so far been on there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an exception, but I think you're right.
If they weren't preserving it, maybe we wouldn't have been able to see Claudette Colbert's nipples.
But you really can make them out.
Yep. Walls of Jericho. Maybe Gable can't see her undressing, but we can see her essentially undressed. Okay, so that was It Happened One Night. Up next on the Top 100 Project is another Clark Gable flick and another Best Picture winner, Mutiny on the Bounty.
In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. You can reach us by email also at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And follow us on Twitter @Top100Project. And cut.